Museum of the Moving Image welcomes you to the Pinewood Dialogues Online, an archive of conversations with innovative creative figures in film, television, and digital media. Visit Museum of the Moving Image in New York City or online at www.movingimage.us.
Actually, everybody got a copy of your book, The American Cinema, yeah, in their gift bags, but I always hold up my copy, which is in pieces because it's been...
Great compliment.
But and of course, also a beat up copy, not as damaged because it's hardcover of Molly's book, Reverence to Ray. But of course, she also wrote Love and Other Infectious Diseases, and Holding My Own in No Man's Land, Woman and Man in Films and Television. So thank you so much for being here. We were actually doing going around the room before doing kind of life stories and talking about how we got interested in film, and I realized that I had heard about this like famous date where you went to see Scorpio Rising, but I didn't know before like what your interest in film, because obviously you were like working for the French Film Office, you were already very interested in film, but could you tell us a bit about your early interest and how you got into this?
Yeah, well, of course there were no film courses then. This was in the late 50s, early 60s when I was in college, and you know, of course, none when Andrew, 11 years earlier, of course. But I went to, I had gone to London, well, it was really Paris. In fact, we happened to be in Paris at the same time, but we didn't know each other, which is probably a fortunate thing. I don't think we were quite ready for each other at that point. But the one thing you do in Paris, of course, is see American movies, French movies. Just, it's a kind of an immersion course in film appreciation. So I just went to the movies all the time. Theater was my first interest, but then I was just caught up in the cinephilia of the 60s, and I had this job, got this great job at the French Film Office. It's a French government agency that does sort of publicity. It's the publicity arm of the French film industry, which is subsidized, so it's all this sort of government stuff. So I was putting out a newsletter in English for the American journalists, and also interpreting when directors came, and it was the sort of height of the Nouvelle Vague, and Truffaut and Godard and Chabrol and all these people were coming over. So it was just a great time, and it was during that I was meeting all the sort of New York film critics, and I wanted to get into this area. I really loved it, and some of them would sort of throw off that they had more assignments. Like, I remember Joe Morgenstern, I think my very first writing about film, Joe Morgenstern was then Newsweek critic, right, and he had something for USIA magazine, and he passed it along to me. And then I met Andrew, and of course he was like the great auteurist, and I had read him religiously in The Voice and saw him moderating panels at the New York Film Festival, and the opportunity, so he called, he was doing an article for GQ on Jean-Paul Belmondo and wanted him, people would call me for information, we had huge files on French directors and stars, and he wanted to do one on Belmondo, and did I have information? So I was so excited that I was finally going to meet him, but he just didn't come, and he didn't come. And finally, I was at a screening of Scorpio Rising, and all things. And the publicist, I think Andrew, I could see.
Where? Do you remember where?
Like it was at the 1600 Broadway, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was the only one. They didn't have 1619. They
a press screening of Scorpio Rising.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Okay. And Rudy Franklin was a publicist, and I saw Andrew, because this was the days of the miniskirt, and I saw Andrew sort of ogling me, and he went over and asked Rudy Franke. I could see him saying, you know, who is that? And Rudy and saying, oh, that's who that is. So he had already talked to me, so he came over and introduced himself, and he was full of this kind of, I mean, he had been a film freak growing up in Queens, right near here. And all of his social skills were kind of learned from the movie. So he
Kew Gardens.
So that was just kind of elaborate, you know, hello. And so I thought, well, now he's met me. He'll come right over. But he still didn't come. But he finally did. And then, so he asked me, our first date was to see a daytime screening of the Chabrol film, Les Bonnes Femmes. For two people from such different backgrounds, we had remarkably similar tastes and still do, I think. We vary sometimes in degree, but you generally not essentially about what we like and don't like. And so Chabrol was one of our first loves, and then he took me for our first date to Howard Johnson's. And he slurped a sundae and tell me at least sort of minimal prospects, but somehow that didn't deter me, so that was he was then doing Cahiers du Cinéma in English, and that's right, he gave me an assignment. There were four French films at the Museum of Modern Art, and I got to write about them. And then he was expanding the film. I started doing theater stuff for The Voice, and that was funny because The Voice, of course, the huge investment of The Voice was in off-Broadway and off-off-Broadway, so the top critics were going to review things in churches and basements and all this avant-garde stuff, so they put me on the Broadway beat.
I was like...
Four-string critics, I was doing Broadway, so I was doing 1776. And so then, at that time, Andrew was going to expand the film coverage, so he had me and Tom Allen and Bill Paul and some other people do. I was very eager to write about film.
Had you written about film before this assignment?
Well, I did Morgenstern for USIA magazine, all the stuff I had done for the French, for the Uni-France Bulletin. I mean, that was a real good apprenticeship, because I was writing about the new Truffaut, Godard, and the new Louis de Funès as well, sort of boulevard stuff as well as art cinema. And so then I think the Cahiers du Cinéma was the first, and I remember there was this group, the National Society of Film Critics, and they had just begun, and they would meet in different critics' apartments. There were only about 12 of them. There were all the people on the weeklies, and it was to counter the Bosley Corella. Does anybody here even remember who that is?
Well, he's come up a few times.
We've
been talking about him a lot.
Have you? The anti-gold standard, I guess. Everybody was reacting against him because the Times had such huge power. So this group, the National Society,
especially the foreign films,
was formed to counter the Bosley Crowther influence. It was a very fractious group because it had Pauline and Andrew and John Simon and Hollis Alpert and Arthur Knight and who else was in it? Joe Morgenstern. Was he in it then?
He was in it for a while.
So Crowther at the time was on the New York Film Critics Circle.
Yeah.
And then you formed the National
Society. All the newspapers were on that. And
right.
This was none of the same people really were in this group. And it was to counter that. So I came in one time with Andrew, and in the course of it, they nominated and voted on Stanley Kaufman to be the head of the group. And he said, "Well, the first thing I want to know is, what is Molly Haskell doing here?" shriveled into. So then it was sort of like I had to get revenge. I had to become a film critic so I could be a legitimate member of the National Society of Film Critics. So that was kind of what it was like in those early days.
Is it true? I remember in Love and Other Impressions. I don't remember the election, but there was a year where Mr. Sarris was at the Village Voice, and you were at, I think, New York.
Right.
Yeah.
So y'all were kind of...
It was terrible.
I mean, was it a case where y'all were reviewing the same film?
Movies.
And
yeah.
Did y'all have different, like, would y'all have disagreements and be like...
Well, first of all, we would try even to go to different screenings, not even go together.
Right.
And then one of the things we always do is talk about films after. We couldn't do that because we would either use or react against or somehow be affected by each other's ideas. So it was just a horrible period. And we were sure everyone was just comparing. I'm sure people weren't paying that much attention, but we sort of were sure everyone was comparing the reviews and saying this is hers, is his worst, hers is worse. So it was just extremely uncomfortable. And then I guess, for better or worse, I got canned from New York Magazine, so that didn't arise again, and I was at Vogue for a while. But that was the only time that happened, because obviously at The Voice, you were first string critic, and you were giving us stuff, but all good stuff. I mean, you weren't just giving us the... It was a horrible thing,
because the person who hired you left right afterwards.
That's right. Yeah.
And left you, very defenseless there in New York.
Somebody who I didn't get along with.
Yeah.
And who then became very
famous. Well, I finally was forced out of The Voice by somebody.
Well, we all know
what that's like. We're all in trouble.
You were just the first of many to
The
Voice. Yeah.
I've been struggling trying to do a memoir, and I haven't made much progress in it, so don't hold your breath. I had been, you know, pretty much most of my life. My story starts around much earlier than Molly's in this field. I had gone to Columbia in 1946. I was admitted to Columbia College, and I was one of only 50 civilians that year who were admitted to the college, and the rest were all returning veterans who were somewhat older, more responsible. A lot of them were married. I never went through a Joe College period, you know, because most of my classmates, and my roommate actually, because I stayed up at Livingston Hall in Columbia, was in the Army, and he had a family and so on. So it was a strange period, and I remember one time late in the period, and Columbia College is where I followed Jack Kerouac, who was a predecessor, down from 116th Street down to 3rd Street in the Village. I used to walk all these distances and go to a lot of revival houses. And that's when I developed my mania for film. And I remember there was a course being given in creative writing, and this was about 1948, 49. And it was given by a literary eminence called F.W. Dupuy. I don't know if any of you have ever heard of him or know about him. But anyway, I was in the golden age of Columbia, the Columbia faculty, Trilling and Van Doren and Mark Van Doren and a lot of other people, the father of the quiz cheater. You had to be interviewed to take the course. And so Dupuy asked me, Andrew, what do you want to write? And I said, I would like to write some film criticism. Because by then I was going down 42nd Street and other places. And there were these secondhand magazine stores. I used to particularly like to read the old Esquires. We had Meyer Levin in the 30s. And they had great writers writing for Esquire back then. Ernest Hemingway wrote writing an essay on a new upcoming fighter called Joe Louis. You know, and I remember him saying that Joe Louis was the only fighter he'd ever seen who could turn a right hook into a right cross in midair, and this was long before Lewis was world champion and so forth. So I thought there were these great essays of Gilbert Seldes, whose daughter is still acting in the Broadway theater, The Seven Lively Arts, and Meyer Levin was a critic, and Patterson Murphy, and then I read other old 30s magazines with Graham Greene and other writers and so on. So I was very steeped in a lot of these things. I'd gotten steeped not only in old films, but in the old film critics. And so I said, I want to write some film criticism. Said, oh, no, you don't want to do that. Nobody interested in film criticism. And anyway, we've already lost
film criticism is dead, right?
He was a pretty decent writer, but you know he's gone to Hollywood. He's writes and he ruined his career.
AG, he said.
James A.G.
Yeah. James A.G. Yeah, and now that was that. But I still persevered. I wrote some film criticism, which is not very good. In fact, now I teach film seminar at Columbia.
Film criticism seminar.
And the kids there now write much better than I was writing back then. I wasn't writing that well. But anyway, after that, I went to graduate school for a while. And then I went into the Army. I just dropped my academic deferment, and I went in the Army during the Korean War. And that was 52. I mean, Eisenhower was just coming into office. To 54, and I was let out a little early so I could finish my master's, which I never finished. And they finally gave me one after about my 10th book, you know, and just a sort of an honorary master's.
Well, no, they let your book be your thesis, didn't they?
Yeah, they let it be the thesis, yeah. Oh, anyway. So anyway, at that time, I didn't have a job. I was a complete failure, flop, and everything. And I went to teacher's college. I figured, well, at least I can teach English in Queens High School, you know. So I took a course, one of the few courses that was being given in the United States then by a man called Roger Tilton, who did a film called Jazz Dance. And he did, for that time, which was about the winter of 54, 55, that time, it was one of the few film courses being given in the United States. And there was one in NYU by somebody who never went very far, an academic who fooled around with the female students too much and never advanced. So I was, you know, always raising my hand, you know, and I had all this background with all these old movies. And one day, a strange man named Jonas Mekas walked into the classroom, and he was starting a new film magazine called Film Culture. And it was a glossy magazine, and somehow he had come to the United States about 5 years earlier. It's supposed to have been Lithuanian poet laureate. And he was a very strange man. And he needed an editor, because he had these fantastic articles from abroad, but they were, the English was comme ci, comme ça, you know. And so I said, okay, you know, there was no money in it. So I said, okay, I'll do the editing if you let me review a movie. And he says, okay, that's fair enough. So that was my first review. It was The Country Girl. I don't know how many of you have ever seen it.
Oh, yeah.
With Bing Crosby, the Clifford Odets play. It was on Broadway with...
Coming back to Broadway now, right?
I mean, the Hogan.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a revival.
Yeah.
Mike Nichols directing.
It's still around, I guess. And I wrote the review. And at that time, I was having two other students in the course. One of them, Eugene Archer, was in a course. Graduated from general studies and had gotten a sort of routine job at the Times. And he later won a fellowship to go to Paris to study the things of Henry James or something. He spent all his time at the Cinematheque, and we were both fascinated by film and history of film. And he really grew up with film, very great film. So we exchanged all kinds of, and collaborated and so forth. But anyway, so I used to go for coffee after the class, and so I wrote this, you know, this review, blasting the movie, blasting Crosby being horribly miscast. I think Paul Kelly played it on stage, and William Holden, and Grace Kelly got an Oscar for it. I just blasted her too, and blasted everybody. And that was the first time I'd really seen my name in print, or my writing in print. And I said, who's this crazy guy, you know? And I realized how powerful print was. And from that point on, I began to tamp it down. But that was the first review, 1955. So I've been writing reviews, so you might say 52 years.
But you didn't moderate your tone and temper that much.
No. I always had kind of peculiar arrogance.
Yeah, you did.
Because I was spoiled rotten by a mother who thought I was...
Well, I mean, you wouldn't have done American cinema if you hadn't. That was
no.
Something crazy about doing
it,
that.
It is crazy.
The presumptuousness.
The presumption,
it.
Yeah.
But and the voice jobs was 1960? Is that when you started?
Well, 1960 was... Yeah. I had done a few other pieces for Film Culture in the meantime. In the 1960, I got a job. I was doing other things, other jobs, just to make a living. And in 1960, I got a job through political connection. My mother had some political connections in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. And so it was a complicated story. So I was a technical officer in the census 1960 in Brooklyn, and I'm walking down the street in Williamsburg, and who should I bump into again but Jonas Mikas? And Jonas is shooting a film.
Huh? He was the patron saint.
He was the patron saint. Yeah, he's responsible for me being here today or being anywhere, anywhere except in Queens teaching English, you know, or trying to teach English. But anyway, so he said, you know, I'm working on my film right now, and he was doing the editing in Williamsburg. That's how he happened to be walking down the street in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. And he said, I'm doing a film. It's Guns in the Trees. I must say, I feel very disloyal, but it was a terrible film. But anyway, and I felt that way about my benefactor. You know, I never wrote anything negative about Jonas, but I, you know, I wasn't into experimental films and so forth. But anyway. And he was editing it in a little place. In fact, I wound up on the cutting room floor. I was in the film briefly, and then they cut me out. But I was supposed to be looking at some books on the shelf and something. And I was just a cameo appearance. But he says, you know, I have a column in this paper I'm doing, a paper I work for. It's Village Voice out in, you know, it was a throwaway paper. Although it's always charged admission, charged for copies. And he says, I need somebody to fill in for me for a few weeks. You know, so you can imagine New York Times, you know, somebody saying to me, you know, Manola or Scott saying to me, you know, I like to take a few weeks off. Why don't you walk in there and take my place? You know, I walk in there and they throw me out the window. And that's a big building now. And, but Voice was such a strange place in those days because Jerry Talmer was the editor, and he was all into off-Broadway. In fact, I recently reviewed a new movie with Al Pacino in it, who's now about 67, and he looks it too. And I saw him. We saw him together in The Indian Wants the Bronx when you were reviewing.
I
think you reviewed
that.
I think you reviewed that. The Indian Wants the Israel Hallward's play way back in those days. And so I walked into the place, and Talmer was the editor of the entertainment section. But he was much all hipped up. He invented off-Broadway. He invented Obies and everything else. And he later, you know, waited in vain for Richard Watts to die or something and to take over the drama thing of the Post. And sad story. But anyway, Talmer looked at me, you know, didn't know me from Adam. And because I walked in with my first review, which was Psycho. Alfred Hitchcock. I had seen it just a few days before, and I just dashed off one of these kind of cinema reviews. And Talmud didn't like Psycho. He didn't like Janet Leigh's bra. He thought it was typical of Hollywood's plasticity, you know, something. So on and so forth. But when the piece appeared, and it was strictly a cahier de cinema piece, French influenced and everything, André Bazin, son of André Bazin.
Well, this is when nobody took Hitchcock seriously,
Everybody liked Hitchcock, but, you know.
But not as an artist.
And not as a serious artist, you know, and I compared him to, you know, artists at off-Broadway and so forth. And they got more hate mail for that one piece than they'd ever gotten before. And that sort of established my reputation at the Voice. I sort of made people, that arrogant tone I had that, know it all to them. That's in the American cinema too, and for no good reason. So that's how I became a critic, and that was 1960. So you might say that was the beginning of my weekly.
Could you talk about the sort of interest you were gaining in taking American cinema seriously? I think that Dan Talbot was just starting to program, like Howard Hawks movies, around that time, and you know, but that was the exception to the rule. The repertory theaters were showing European films.
Oh, yeah. Dan Talbot, we became friends. And in New York, a theater at that time was reviewing, they would do old people like Howard Hawks and Hitchcock Festival, Chaplin, and also the foreign people, Bergman and Fellini. Yeah.
Of course, that was the art cinema, but it was very unusual.
It was very unusual to do.
They were the only ones.
Yeah, they were to do the old American movies.
There was a lot of revival theater in those days, down at the Bleecker Street Cinema and all that, but they were mostly French.
Yeah, mostly
French.
Yeah.
Italian and French.
Well,
what
else? There were these things on the Beverly. You know, there were all these Under the L and all that. There were a lot of theaters that were showing these old classics. There was a theater on 55th Street. It later became a sort of a porn theater, but at that time it would do things like all the films of Preston Sturges.
Oh, really?
You know, and so on, so forth. So this was nothing new. But at that point, we became Archer and me became very friendly with Dan Talbot and with people like Peter Bogdanovich and so forth, who was originally in theater. And later was interested in film, too.
But this was the beginning of the reevaluation of American cinema.
It's beginning.
But did Gene Archer get any of that taste into the times or not? He really didn't.
Well, no, he didn't get the taste of the the politique. No, Archer was a very sad story, because Archer sort of introduced the Nouvelle Vague directors in the Times. Mm-hmm. He was a fourth string film critic, but he also did a lot of essays for the Sunday paper. And he had taken up, he had mastered typing in the Air Force. He was an Air Force veteran. And he could type like 90 words a minute. He was fantastic.
Wow.
He was the fastest typist I've ever met. And he could knock off articles like in an afternoon, like nothing. But he was doing the Nouvelle Vague directors, and he felt that they owed him, So then when he left the Times, he became infatuated he wanted to get into making films, making art films, and he wanted the French to help him. And, as long as he was on the Times, the French would look into his eyes, But when he left the Times, the French directors looked past him. And that's something if you ever get an influential berth, and people look into your eyes, don't take it too seriously, because if they lose that opportunity to be publicized, they're going to look right past you. I saw that happen firsthand, and so that's why I've never taken anything people told me seriously. I mean, celebrities, actors, so forth.
You both changed American film criticism so much. I wonder if you agree that you've also changed American movies.
I think just in the sense that all directors now think of themselves as artists.
That's
not so much from the critics, it's from European cinema too. They wanted to be like...
Yeah, well it was a freak. Now, the American cinema is based on a issue of Cahiers, which did all the American directors, with their pictures, but won a whole issue.
That came out when?
That came out, this I wrote after the Pauline Kael controversy. Pauline wrote this, because I wrote a piece in Film Culture called Notes on the Auteur Theory.
Before you did the
book. Yeah, in 1962. So I dated from that period, 62, and so around 63, 64, Pauline launched into her creative attack in the Film Quarterly, And I had never seen her up to that point. I'd read her, but I hadn't seen her. I thought she was a babe, you know. I thought she, because I hadn't seen her. And I wasn't worried. I wasn't worried too much.
She never had that image of you as being a hunk.
No.
She never figured you for, Andrew.
No. Well, I
recognized you for a film.
Yeah, well, Marion Maggott, who used to write the commentary, you know, she said that we were like Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn, and she was certainly not Katharine Hepburn, but she said, well, you were certainly not Spencer Tracy. You know, so that put me in my place. But, it wasn't Pauline who said that, it was Marion Maggott, my friend. But anyway, the piece came out in 62, and that got this, and everybody agreed with her, you know. Everybody in the literary and film establishment pretty much agreed with her. And I was the crazy one, and because if I had to do it over again, people asked me, would I do it differently? When Truffaut wrote his article, La Politique des Auteurs, and he coined the phrase La Politique des Auteurs, what he meant by politique was not theory, but policy. You know, it was like, you know, the French, after World War II, the French critics were, you know, they were, I guess, too young for the war or something. The French, during the occupation, they could not see any American movies during the 40s. So after the war, they saw, like, Monsieur Arcadin. At the same time, they saw Citizen Kane for the first time, or Magnificent Ambassadors for the first time.
So they showed the continuity.
Yeah. They began to think of clusters of films rather than, and so that was the model for the American cinema. But I changed it somewhat because I wanted to make stronger distinctions between who I thought were the great directors and who I thought were in between. And of course it was wild, and some of it was I revised it later. Billy Wilder, for example, is my notorious case. I less than meets the eye category, and there I was influenced too much by Truffaut. Truffaut wrote a very negative article. Truffaut didn't like Lubitsch or Wilder. Those were his blind spots, and I think partly because later I found that the reason the French understood these American movies and these genre directors was that they didn't know English very well, and therefore they weren't. Pauline was notorious at screenings that somebody would say some stupid line, and she'd go, ah, you know, and that was the end of that movie. You know, that was she intimidated everybody. She was a very forceful person. But the French, they couldn't pick up these whoppers. And so they went for these genre films, and they could appreciate them. So anyway, a combination of things. But what really motivated the American cinema was that was my rebuttal to Pauline. That was my rebuttal, because I wrote a very weak rejoinder, and it wasn't very effective, and so I really just put the whole thing together, and that was a rejoinder to Pauline's thing.
Could you just I love the phrases you came up with, the pantheon, strange seriousness.
Oh yeah,
like they still work today. It kind of says it all,
an article in Tomorrow's Times in the entertainment section,
You've seen it
with a tribute to Ebert, to Roger Ebert, and
the French critic Ebert.
Yeah,
Roger Colbert, Stephen Colbert, Roger Ebert.
Yeah, what he says finally, you know, he's talking defending Ebert's, you know, thumbs up, thumbs down thing, and he says all criticism, and I agree with him on that particularly. All criticism, I feel I am the sum of every conversation I've ever had about movies, from way back, from time I was in high school, college, you know, all the conversations I've ever had, I've always looked for people who had something interesting to say about anything. And I think most critics, most writers would say that they are the sum of every conversation they've ever had. And I think, you know, I was the sum of all the conversations I had. But, you know, I also had my own, you know, eccentricities and things. But, you know, basically, it was a collaborative. But the thing about the Pantheon and so forth, one of the people that had a great deal of influence on me was a fellow called Stephen Gottlieb, who was a good friend and still a good friend of mine. And his father was a Hollywood producer, produced the Abbott and Costello movies. Mm-hmm. And he invented a lot of those categories. He suggested a lot of them. And I just seized upon it and used them and stuck people into these categories. That's the way that evolved.
Looking back, don't you think that you raised a few consciousnesses about feminism in Hollywood, at least for a little while?
For a little while, that's a good catch, I think, really. It's really distressing to me to see, because there was a lot of conversation going on at that time, this was like the 70s and the early 80s, about the roles of women in film, and not just among film, I mean, male film critics were concerned that weren't enough good roles for women, and there were columnists talking about it, and now it's like, feminism is a dirty word or something, and the Arts and Leisure section never does anything on, from a woman's perspective or a feminist perspective, ever. I mean, I used to do a lot of pieces for them. Part of it was some kind of, I guess, new people came in. But I think, you know, the situation, I mean, it's not as if there's there are no women, because there are women, more women directors than there have been in a while and some interesting roles, but I think Hollywood has just gone over to the adolescent male on both sides of the camera, you know, in the films, and I'm thrilled to see as many women here today as there are, because I think even film criticism is, at least official film criticism, is very dominated by men. And I don't quite know what's happened. I mean, I think it's cyclical, so maybe it'll change. I mean, I do. I have a lot of theories about what's going on, but yeah, I think there was a generally raised consciousness there for a while, and I think it was a more interesting. I mean, I think, like, the whole Hillary thing is now raising the issue again, but it also exposes, I think, the deep misogyny that there is in our culture, well, on the part of women as well.
You pointed out that parallel between Cape Couric, the way everybody jumps on Cape Couric and Hillary, it's the same kind of thing.
Well, that you, and I also was doing a big, the New York Film Society is doing their tribute to Meryl Streep this year. And I was thinking, I had to write a piece for Film Comment, and I was looking at her films, and it's amazing the career she's had, given the time she's lived in. But she's made something like 43 films at a time when most actresses of, you know, of her age group have fallen by the wayside or just doing minor stuff. And she's made the transition to character actress. I think she's sort of more fun now, in a way, than she's been a long time. But you can see her playing these unsympathetic roles really interestingly all through her career and sort of think about what that means. But, I mean, she even does a kind of Hillary lookalike in Manchurian Candidate. Actually, I watched it again. She really does utilize Hillary's gestures and very, very consciously model. And I think there's one, I don't know if anyone saw that, there's one where she plays an Upper West Side shrink, Prime, I think it was called. Mm-hmm. Yeah, did you see that? It's a very funny movie, and Uma Thurman is her patient, and Uma Thurman is going out with this younger guy, and gradually she keeps talking about what they're doing and all these wild things they're doing. Meryl Streep finally realizes it's her son, and she's this very kind of emancipated, liberal thinking psychotherapist about, oh yeah, it's fine if you go out with a Jew, and then suddenly it's her son, and she's a Jewish mother, and she's just, you know, going crazy about this. But I think she's playing Pauline Kael a little bit in that. She has this kind of, you know, breathy, intense, I don't know, it's very funny. But anyway, I think it kind of illuminates the difficulty women have in, from Kramer versus Kramer on, playing an unsympathetic role. And it's like Katie Couric, if she had the so-called gravitas that these other male people supposedly have, then nobody would like her as a woman because she wouldn't be feminine. So it's a really no-win situation, I think. It's a little different from the Hillary thing, but similar. So.
What are your theories that you were alluding to?
Excuse me?
You said you had some theories about...
Well, I think it's a terror of female power, basically. I mean, I think it's both Freudian and social. I mean, I think a lot of the violence in the world now is from a kind of threatened male supremacy. And I think this kind of retreat into adolescence of the sort of Judd Apatow things and the male bonding. I mean, we've seen this before, but it's for instance, David Denby had an interesting piece about the sort of disappearing romantic comedy, and he talked about Knocked Up. And he says, why can't the Katherine Hegel character and the women get smart lines like they used to get in screwball comedy? I want to write about this sometime, but I think the difference is that in screwball comedy, women didn't have jobs. So they got to be smart talking, and they were. I mean, you don't see women in movies ever talking like that today. In fact, in one of Andrew's classes, he was showing a screwball comedy once, and the girls in the class said, well, she's so mean. You know, this back talk. They were really sort of shocked at that. So you have women not talking like that, but they have the job. I mean, here's this Amazon woman, Katherine Hegel, with this powerful job. And this is what the men are terrified of retreating from. And I look at the arts and leisure section. You'll know these people. I don't. There's an actor in the movie section who's doing a movie's coming out where he's exposed for however many minutes on the screen because his girlfriend is leaving him. He's in the shower. And then there's another one about this guy in the tub. With John Malkovich, he's doing a YouTube type little video, and he's nude. I mean, there's something going on where there's this regression, this endless male regression, and I think it is a retreat from women, and I think it goes back. I mean, it's this sort of powerful woman in the where a woman is allowed to be. I mean, I was talking to a man recently, and he said something. I think I've said this too, but it sort of reinforced it, that the difference between, say, Hillary and Golda Meir or Thatcher is that they can be maternal people. They're older. They're not romantically viable at all. Whereas Hillary is your wife or your sister. She's not the maternal figure yet. So I think it's just too threatening. So you're allowed to be one thing or the other. You can be politically powerful, or you can be a feminine woman. And the thing is that I think there are other issues too. I wouldn't say that people who are against Hillary are necessarily anti-feminist or anti-female, because I think there can be other issues, but I do think that's a huge part of it. And I think it's that everything she's had to do, people can't stand her because of who she is, and she had to become that person to get to where she got to be. So it's a kind of impossible conundrum. Yeah.
I want to say one kind thing about Pauline Kael, who's my mortal enemy forever.
Non-sexual.
Definitely about non-sexual women. Yeah, and I think the one contribution she's made to film criticism, lasting contribution, because I always felt she went up and down, you know, this, and she was more interesting as a writer than I think as a real critic. But one of the things she did is that she gave a license to all film critics, male and female, to say that something turned them on. And, you know, in the old, before she came along, there was always, you know, oh, by the way, you know, and everybody was, especially the male critic, Bosley Crowley, were very aloof from the whole subject. They never suggested that anybody got them going. And she made it possible for people to I think that's a great contribution.
It is. It's interesting that
people,
a woman
people
did
are
it
very very honest. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think a man could have quite done that.
No.
Yeah.
Without violating the canons of good taste.
Go ahead, Brett.
I was going to ask, just how big was the whole Pauline, you know, explosion and what all of you were doing? Because I think it came up the other day. I mean, there's a question of whether or not something like that could happen right now, but it's not totally clear to some of us exactly how far that reach was. I mean, I imagine people didn't have, you know, pictures of her, you know, T-shirts or something like that, you know. I mean,
well, it was kind of the rock star thing, but in a very much more minor way. But some people thought it was crazy. But there were three people that were in contention. It was Andrew and Pauline and John Salmon. I remember they once had the Times invited each of you to vent. And some people thought, wow, these people, you know, what is this all about?
I don't think it was Pauline. I think that was me and
you
John.
You and John Salmon, okay.
Just me and John.
That's right, yeah.
Pauline wouldn't participate in that.
Yeah.
So it was beneath her dignity.
Well, it was like this was the period of, you know, peak sort of cinephile, and film critics had never had any, you know, nobody at that point grew up and went to film critic things or became film critics, and suddenly film itself was hot, you know, it was just exciting and people were talking about it, that whole era of just concentration on it, and great movies were coming out, so there was, and people were reading The Voice and they were reading all that, there was this cinephilia, so as a consequence, the people who, I think, were changing the look of things and the taste, which was Andrew, and John was sort of rear guard, I mean, he was an elegant writer, but kind of rear guard.
The best critic of the 19th century.
Yeah, whereas Pauline. So, and there were people who, they really were sort of factions. I mean, they didn't all get lined up and vote or anything, but don't you think they really were people who felt John Salmon was holding up the standards of the... Pauline and Andrew
Well,
were
well
these,
also, wow. also he served a very useful function. You know, people would say, isn't it awful what John Salmon wrote? You know, saying that Liza Minnelli has no chin. Now, isn't that terrible?
Yeah, they were quoting.
They were always quoting him, using him, so they could say something nasty that wouldn't be stuck to them, you know. Now, the other thing about John that I realized when I went to England is that, finally went to England, is that in England, John Simon would just be lost in the shuffle. Everybody in England is so nasty that John would just be one of the crowd, you know. But here in America, we all want to be nice guys, you know. We all want to be friendly with everybody and
also respectable. So this was a really unbuttoned period of writing. I mean, this was, I think that Pauline did break some kind of barrier a language barrier, politeness barrier. So that was, it was exciting.
But was it still just restricted to your community of people that you knew? I mean, or did you really get a sense that, you know, someone on the street or someone who just liked going to the movies was aware of this kind of... You
know, did the average stockbroker know that?
Not stockbroker, but people in the arts and who were interested in the arts. Yeah, I think we're in on the conversation. Or, I mean, and some not. I mean, I remember when those two articles appeared in the Times, a lot of people thought, what is... We're sort of shocked that the Times would run it and that you all would do it. I mean, because it was something that they were attacking each other, and a lot of people were made uncomfortable by that, I think. Mm-hmm. So that was a lot of it. It was
especially, because I was much nastier than John.
I didn't want him to do it.
Mike was against
thing.
Me doing it at all, but I
had to do it. So I don't know, that was a mixed thing, but I think the general conversation was exciting, and Susan Sontag was writing about movies, and you know, it was just, everybody was discovering things, and I think that was more important, really, than the tensions between, I think, in a funny way, we were less aware of, I mean, we knew that Pauline and Andrew had this run-in kind of in print, but afterwards, it was her acolytes that have sort of kept it alive, in a way, more than Andrew had. I don't know quite what, don't you think that's true a little bit?
Yeah, they had a hard time letting go.
Yeah, for some reason. And they say Andrew's the one that can't let it go, because he does refer to Pauline from time to time, but I don't think it's a kind of constant
after all,
chafing thing on for you that it is for them.
No, the whole thing...
Well, Andrew became more of an academic, and there was a difference, because Andrew really did I mean, Pauline believed in it, the now is everything. Don't look back. And she didn't like to look at films again, whereas Andrew's the opposite.
She said, and I can't believe she actually said this, she never sees a movie more than once.
She said that a lot.
She said that, yes.
She said that a lot. That was her trademark.
I don't know. She might have looked at it again. She couldn't resist.
I read an interview with her where she said that because she was closing a piece, after she closed, she did go back, I think, on Nashville, McCabe, and I think also Tagus of the War, just to like fact check. So I know like those three films.
She did admit to going
back again, but she put it in the context of, well, I closed the piece, or I was about to close the piece, I wanted to make sure I got all of my facts straight. And then she immediately, I remember in the interview, she said, but I've already dealt with the film, so it doesn't have an effect on me. I was watching it.
Yeah. She feels that she can do it all on the one viewing.
Maybe she had an absolutely photographic memory too. But I can't believe she would deprive herself of the pleasure of going back to old 30s and 40s films.
I wanted to ask you, Molly, when you did this, because it was, I think, unusual for when you wrote From Reverence to Rape to be looking back at Hollywood movies that you sort of reframed Hollywood and you went back to the 20s.
And then how did
you get to see this?
Yeah, because there were no VCRs and no. Museum of Modern Art, and there was a guy, Bill Everson, who used to show films in his home.
He was quite insane. He was our Henri Langlois.
His apartment, basically.
And there were a few that Andrew gave me. In fact, Andrew, there was one, what was the one that I hadn't seen that you had to fill me in on? Was the one with Margaret Sullivan and Charles Boyer, which is
Backstreet.
Was it Backstreet? Yeah. Where she's the working girl that...
With John Bowles.
He started telling me the plot, and he got so choked up. Because he was a real sucker for these old women films. It's one of the things I love about him. He loved those movies. But basically, I did see them, and I don't know. It just... That would seem to be the only way to do it. I mean, I've only recently seen Theda Bauer. You couldn't see her. That wasn't available at all, but you could see stills and read about them and get a sense of them. But I think most everything in there I had seen.
Yeah.
Cynthia.
There was some concern among academics, elsewhere as well, I think during the 70s and 80s, sort of feminist criticism, not only film criticism, but that it was very white focused. In film criticism.
Not just that, but somebody, one of the theoreticians, criticized me as, that I was an uncritical celebrator of heterosexual romance. And I thought, this is what it was the medium. We were not critical of it because it was pre sort of gay rights and even the, we were we were critical of the patriarchal biases, but not of racial and sexual ones particularly.
Those have their own separate entities. And you can do all of it combined and all, but it seemed like, you can focus on just one thing at a time.
I think so. I mean, I don't think I could. I mean, I did deal with those few black films that there were.
But that's interesting. There wasn't that. I mean. Back before, 25 years ago, black female performers, you're dealing with a very, small amount of footage you can deal with.
I'm not particularly apologetic about it. I think I'm a prisoner of the times as much as anybody else, and this was the focus, this was the orientation then, and I think we were certainly more aware of race as time went on than we were of gay.
At the time seeing Douglas Sirk films or certain films at the time, was it apparent to some people who were intellectuals or whatever that there was coding in those films that supposedly, according to the celluloid closet, that the gay audiences could get, but maybe the straight audiences didn't get? I mean, were you aware that some films had coding, but you just couldn't talk about it? Or was it later on that, you went back to see it and I see the coding. Rebecca. I mean, they always talk about Rebecca, the homoeroticism, the lesbianism that's hinted at in Rebecca. I mean, were you aware of that?
Judith Anderson.
Oh, that's certain after. Well, it's certainly something like Mercedes McCambridge and Joan Crawford and Johnny Guitar. Yeah.
Was that aware? Was
that, but Sirk, I don't think people were reading it. I mean, they weren't even, it was sort of
A.G. used to write about Nance actors. And there were a whole group
Edward Everett Horton. They were gay,
other character actors who were sort of sissies.
And it wasn't even coded. They would do like this.
Yeah. And they were very, they were brilliant actors. They were all of them were brilliant, but they were coded, but they were coded as sissy actors.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And very often they'd be like Billy DeWolf. Later it was one of the latest ones. He would always be the failed suitor of a girl. Everybody would laugh at the idea of Billy DeWolf.
Well, like Rebel Without a Cause. You look at Rebel Without a Cause now. You know Sal Mineo's character is...
Very explicit, yeah.
Yeah, I think one interesting example is, I think some of it maybe people in the know, I mean, the gay audience was always the most sort of sophisticated about everything, maybe, yeah. But about that. But something like, I look at the Doris Day Rock Hudson films now, and there's a lot of interesting kind of bisexual byplay there where he's a mama's boy, and I think what was interesting is you could sort of have different levels of sort of interpretation, so that I think there's something really nice the way they can sort of have role a little bit of role reversal, and they allows the other. She gets sort of butch when she's with him, and he becomes sort of soft with her. So they weren't as simplistic as people thought at the time, I think. But I think each film is different. I don't think people saw the Sirk. Were the Sirk film seen right away as a comment on as well as full-throated soap opera?
They were seen as very, very perverted. Well, there were people like, who was not explicitly, Otto Kruger was one people, that his personality was, sort of much vaguer.
Gilda, that whole thing in Gilda. Oh, Gilda, so Gilda. Yeah, I mean, you can't miss it, really.
Yeah.
There's a lot going on.
I just want to follow up on what Eric was talking about, just the heyday of film criticism and film culture and cinephilia and, the sense of a very active conversation. What is your sense of where things stand now and why do you think things have changed?
Well, the internet, for one thing. I think I'd love to hear from people who are actually working in that. I'd like to know. I just don't know how people have time to read everything. Because I think there's so many interesting voices and opinions out there, and I'd like to know too. I think that books have been dethroned from the print media in a sense, or at least they've, if not dethroned, they've certainly been diluted by all these other alternate.
Especially with advanced buzz.
That's just a version of what was going on when the National Society of Film Critics formed in reaction to Bosley Crowther.
Yeah.
So there's always a kind of dethroning going on, I think, in one form or another. But there was something more concentrated, I think, about the kind of, which was exciting about the conversation. Now it's just too diffuse, and it just
the problem is that when the National Society of Film Critics was formed to counter Bosley Crowther, y'all were still getting paid. I mean, that's not much. That's what our thing is. I think with us, I mean, we love writing about film, and the print thing has seemed to be shrinking. And I strive to get into print. But the internet is where my stuff is being seen so far, but I'm doing it on my own time.
Well, I often thought that the Observer went under, which it might well, anytime, that maybe we could do a little video thing and talking about a movie. And just because Andrew loves, I think that probably all of you here are like that, just love thinking and writing about movies. So that, I don't think movie criticism, maybe there are a few places now it's well paid, but it never was. And nobody ever went into it for the money, that's for sure. And the Observer is not much about the same as what the Voice.
Well, Brendan Gill used to tease me. He said, Pauline got these good berths, the New Yorker and so forth. And she was much more successful than I was.
Yeah.
And he said, and you worked all your life, for $50 a column, no more, no less, you know. And that was his joke. And it's true. In fact, some students come up to me and they say, oh, we admire you, Mr. Ferris, for sticking to your guns and staying in these low-paying jobs. And I said, you're talking to the wrong guy. If it wasn't the time, I wouldn't have dropped my voice berth and my observer berth to take a New Yorker berth or a Times berth. But nobody wanted me. I mean,
how do you, when you go on the internet, how do you find your audience? I mean, do they just come to you, write, and then come to you? How does it work?
It's very much a two-way street. As much as you putting yourself out there, visiting other people's blogs, leaving an interesting comment,
yeah,
trying to find out what you're about.
Yeah,
it's very much a collegial, community-driven thing.
Yeah.
Do you try to get your stuff linked to a site that's already established, mm-hmm, and they're like, you know, you'll email the person running that site, hey, here's something I wrote, if you, mm-hmm, like it, can you link to it? And that trickles in, and then by that trickling into your piece, maybe they'll come back to you.
Mm-hmm.
And so
I do think there's a corollary, I think, to the days that you were talking about, in that there is a community being built in which people are constantly reaching out to others to sort of more or less balance their opinions against theirs and bounce, mm-hmm, their opinions off them. Find someone that you feel is simpatico with you, you try to develop that relationship. Only on the internet, it seems it primarily happens in comments or emails or something like that. And there is no one big room in New York where everyone gets together to talk about, mm-hmm,
because a lot of people aren't in New York.
Yeah.
Like that, the conversation that's happening on the web is happening with, the entire
region. I feel like that's the key difference between now and your, the 60s and 70s. Like, Sarah's Kale, it's all in
New
one.
York.
It was very provincial. I don't know what the rest of the country, was aware of.
Yeah. Well, also because film criticism had, all there were was newspapers with people who just did reviews. That really, the level wasn't that high. And then it just gradually rose and rose and rose. And, mm-hmm, and another nice thing, I think film critics really, it's a remarkably, they have big egos, but at the same time, I think they really like listening to or reading each other. I think, more than other fields. I don't think literary critics are other. No. I just think there's a collegiality, and that to me is wonderful. I think
the only other thing I would think where is kind of a community is actually probably rock critics,
mm-hmm,
probably the other place where they do, because music is so subjective. In the taste of
visceral.
Know,
both have this visceral thing. Yeah. I think that you get excited about them and you want to talk about them.
Have you noticed any different response to your reviews now that they are available online? The fact that your rave review for My Blueberry Nights is out there all around the world for people to read.
First of all, he doesn't have a computer.
Right. So you're not,
I still use a typewriter.
So
portable.
I get emails sometimes.
Who gets the emails?
The Observer.
Yeah.
I don't think they've stopped sending them. They started sending them to me for a while, and they faxed them to you. We would type out his column, fax it to
literally
computer,
on a manual.
They would convert it to computer, email it to me. I would print it out so he could read it.
It seems to be a manual typewriter. What do you use?
Smith-Corona.
Manual?
Smith-Corona.
Manual,
no,
not even electric.
No, Royal. It's a Royal now. I graduated from Royal.
The ribbons, yeah.
One place in New York.
There's one place in New York that you can get even.
They're still open just for Andrew. They're like Andrew.
There are three other people of it.
Yeah, no, I'm in the Stone Age, Columbia used to give an allowance, to do things outside of academia, and so I finally broke down and bought an IBM notepad. And then I paid somebody $500 a week to teach me how to use it. And then I started thinking, and I said, because Jimmy Breslin, who was my classmate at John Adams High School, not a classmate, he was one term ahead of me, wrote one time a very macho article that he used to go to a newspaper office. And he says, now he walks in and everybody's, at the computer, and he says, it's so easy to edit that the people are sticking extra adjectives on, and everything is becoming a feat. He says, And I said, well, no, I appreciate the macho thing with that, but I've never known anybody who went the whole route and then went back. I mean, you know, it's people like me in Dresden are just too lazy. Okay. To get
what you told you decided was when this guy was.
Oh, well, the thing with Excited is that I've been looking at one screen or another for, you know, like 70 years, and I'm not going to spend the rest of my life looking at a computer screen. And I said, no.
How important is humor in criticism?
I think it's really important.
Which?
Humor. How important?
Oh, humor. Oh, yeah.
Well, first of all, movies are funny, so if you don't.
You have to have.
Well, I don't know. When you think of the Cahiers critics, I don't suppose there was a.
Oh, well, the Cahiers critics.
It was a grim.
Yeah, they were grim.
You never know Sturges was comedy.
Right.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
No, if you don't.
Humor is very important. If you have it, you have it. If you
I'm
don't.
I'm trying to think if there have been any really terrific film critics who haven't had no humor.
Well, the humor, I think, comes out in the reviews I find are kind of funny. Is when it's like a negative review.
Yeah.
When critics can really.
Well, that's easy.
That is.
It's easy.
You can always look good being negative more than being positive. Mm-hmm. It's harder.
But is there a line you cross when you stop being a critic and you become an entertainer that, you know, makes you lose credibility or something like that?
Let's hope so.
What is that?
Well, I think one of the interesting things, you know, I did this series of. Introductions with Robert Osborne on Turner Classic Movies, and it was called The Essential. So it was all movies that they considered, it was mostly their choice. I mean, I chose out of their list, I chose, so it wasn't all my favorite films, but they were all ones that people should see. So after we did this, somebody was saying, well, maybe you and Robert should disagree about a film. And we said, well, if you're doing The Essentials, it's, you can't say this is not a, you know, it's an essential film. But the other thing is people really don't want to see you negative. I mean, Roger and they can get away with it because it's a format. But really on television, people want positive and they want short and positive and not reflective or hesitation.
No. That's something I picked up.
That automatically compromises a little bit any kind of stringent criteria you might have as a critic. So that is a kind of entertainment, I think. It's not criticism.
Well, even the positive, though, even when you're positive about something, you can be funny by being negative about something else. There are a lot of tricks.
You can sneak in
all kinds of negative things.
Yeah,
Siskel Ebert had the right chemistry.
Yeah, they did.
And Siskel is not as not nearly as sharp as Ebert, but he's much closer
to the average
taste than Ebert, because Ebert is a very refined taste. And it's
both of them can sort of enjoy junk. I think you sort of almost have to in this day and age to be a critic or you know, sort of fun trash or whatever you want to call it. There's so many things that they like that I would never be able to like. And they used to, I think there was a dumbing down even there, because they did a lot of foreign films at one point and then they just sort of stopped doing that. And they did.
They don't do enough foreign stuff right now.
Foreign films, there was a time in the 80s when the foreign film was viable, but as time went on, that tripling of.
Well, that happened too.
How many markets do a lot of those movies open in? They have to talk about things that other nations.
But they would do them even though they did have small markets, hoping to get them in more places, I think. Where I don't think they have that kind of missionary thing anymore. And they're more interested in. And they have had a change with the times, DVDs, and all that stuff. And they'll do that with the DVDs in a way, what they used to do with foreign films, by recommending something more obscure.
Things.
What about DVDs? What about the luxury now of not having to write from memory?
That's just unbelievable. Unbelievable. I mean, for all the bad things today, that is the most wonderful to be able to. I mean, also, you know, I've been, when I was doing the Turner Classics and I'm doing a book now, sometimes looking at them on your computer, it's a very interesting perspective, because it's a very intense thing. I mean, you think, oh, no, you can't look at it on a small screen. But if you have the right focal distance from a small screen, it can be just as intense and enveloping as the old days of looking on a great big screen. And that's interesting. I mean, I have this little DVD player that I have lying in bed because I get tired, just a tired person all the time. And I have it sort of on my knees and looking at things, and it's just fantastic.
You don't hear the phone ring or anything.
Yeah, well, I have the earphones.
Well, a student once asked me, you know, I want to write about this film, so how many times should I see it before I write about it? And I said, well, you know, I'll see it once and then go out, go to a concert, or, you know, listen to some music, go to an art gallery, and then come back to it after you've changed, and you'll see the movie has changed. Something has happened. And a student recently asked me, you know, she said, how many times do you see a movie before you review it? And, you know, I'm 100 years old. So, you know, I said, you want me to tell you the truth, or do you want me to tell you a wonderful fiction about seeing it over and over again, so I get all its nuances? So tell me the truth. So I say, I can't afford to see any more movies more than once. I'm in Pauline's shoes right now. And it's very hard. It's very exhausting for me to see movies. And
I'm bringing your experience, but ask them. Because, you know, at one point, Andrew really loved with The Observer to sort of, first of all, he's not ever getting screening invitations, but he would catch something the weekend it opened and then write about it. So it would come out in The Observer after. You know, they want the review to come out right when the movie opens. So that they stopped him doing that, so he can't do that anymore. And I miss it, and because most people don't catch up with it for a week or so. You know, I mean, an indefinite period.
Well, the Voice, most of the years I've worked for The Voice, I would wait 2-3 weeks before I reviewed anything.
Well,
and then I read everybody else.
Yeah. When you all write about movies, do you, first of all, do you go to screenings, and do you keep writing about it even after it's been out for a week or so? How close to opening is your, do you feel your deadline is, or does it?
Did
you have
various?
Yeah. There are some people here who write about movies long before they open.
Uh-huh.
A lot of people here cover festivals.
I mostly go to film festivals and I'll write about a movie, you know, a year before it has comes out. But then I'll often write about it again.
For us, they have to come out the afternoon before the day it opens for those movies, unless they're not screened for critics, and then they'll come out that weekend. But sometimes, if a movie is very important, we'll go back and revisit it in a couple of weeks and talk about the criticism that's been on it.
That's great.
You can go back.
Because it's something that I'm sure editors don't care about at all. It's just something.
They will if it's a movie, if it's something that they think will interest enough.
I have the luxury of writing for an outlet where we're as interested in the critical and popular response to a movie as we are to the movie itself. And so to us, we frequently write about movies well after they open.
Yeah.
And I often wish, and I would be interested to hear your guys' take on this, that more critics saw movies in packed houses. I mean, in packed weekend houses as opposed to in screening rooms or in critic screenings.
Yeah.
So I do think those are very different audiences to see a movie with.
They are, I think. What do you think about that? Well, I don't think you've never been that romantic about, that was the thing Gene Siskel always loved. He loved seeing it with an audience, and I remember.
Yeah. I don't trust audiences. I recently, I was so desperate, you know, to see something that satisfied all the requirements. So I went to the Ziegfeld Theater. I don't know how many of you know the Ziegfeld Theater. It used to be the Ziegfeld Follies were there. And it's a huge place. And there were about 1 million children there.
What was it for? A kid movie.
A kid movie. It was for that one that's made all the money, the elephant movie.
Horton?
Hubert.
Horton. Horton Hears a Who?
Hubert Who?
Oh, yeah.
Whatever. I can't even remember.
Yeah.
And you know, I didn't dare go into the men's room because I might bump accidentally into a boy, a child, and I'd be accused of molestation or something. So I was surrounded by all these children, and they didn't much, you know, laugh at most of it because it's, you know, Dr. Seuss is, you know, a do-gooder, you know, with rice and rhymes and so forth, and this is, you know. And this is defending all the little things in the world, you know. But you know, I remember, you know, the only link I could make, the only significant link, and I wrote very briefly about it, is that who can resist an animated elephant or even a lethargic one, you know? And I'm a great Dumbo enthusiast. I mean, I think Dumbo is my favorite of all animated films I've ever seen. And I think elephants are just wonderful. So I have nothing much to say about it. But I think because I've never had children, I notice various critics use their children, sort of talking points, you know, like their children think and so forth. And I don't have that. I'm just not interested.
I think the real division now, I don't know, I'd like to hear your take on this. In New York, I feel it, there's a kind of film festival film that critics love and most audience that never really audience films, and you see this the New York Film Festival particularly. I mean, some of the Asian films, some of the French films, a lot of these. And Andrew and I were talking about that, or even, you know, I mean, I think the critics loved the Academy Award nominees this year, No Country for Old Men and There Will Be Blood, and I think most audiences around the country really didn't love those so much. I didn't love them so much myself. But people aren't completely honest. And yet they are. If you talk about, we were talking about, if you ask somebody, this is the way movies, I think, used to be in a certain sense. If you ask them what they think of some television program, they're completely honest about it. Because there's no artistic pretense. You love it or you don't. And there's no onus if you didn't like it. Whereas certain movies you don't dare not like, almost. Mm-hmm. And I think that's...
I think television is more interesting right now than movies.
I believe this is a golden age of television.
It is.
Since The Sopranos,
yeah.
99.
There's a lot of great things.
Yeah, just pretty. And it's been more adventurous. I mean, The Wire or anything has been more adventurous.
These are people who decades ago would have been working in Hollywood.
Exactly.
Now those movies aren't getting made, so they can go somewhere.
Exactly.
I mean, Glenn Close is doing her best work on TV that she's ever done. But I do agree that there is. There can be disconnect in a festival reaction and then the audience reaction. I mean, but this is also like a Sundance phenomenon where, you know, they always blame the altitude, where the audience...
They get carried away. Well, that's a little different. They get carried away.
What about adaptation? I mean, it seems like Hollywood is so much more inhospitable to originals than it's ever been before. Everything has to be an underlying property.
Well, it's just invested in formula, whether it's action film or franchise or, you know, or cartoon franchises or all of it is just pre-tested. I think that's true. I think, I mean, they always went for, they like to have some pre-tested property, I think.
I think the bottom line people, you know, the old Hollywood moguls, for all their absurdities and ridiculous, they were proud of their product. They were proud of the quality.
They wanted to improve the world
as well as make money.
Yeah.
The new bottom line people from business schools and so forth, most of them, I don't think, even like movies. That's just of their business, but I think they're more interested in other things. I think they're probably have contempt. Yeah.
Well, most of what you do.
To some extent, I feel like there's less reverence for movies among executives today. But at the same time, if you were really a business person at heart, you wouldn't go into the movie business. I mean, the movie business is such an economically unfeasible business in general for almost everyone. I tend to think there has to be some reason that they're working there.
Well, it has sex appeal, though.
They like the prestige.
Yeah, yes. And you meet glamorous people, and, you know, you smoke cocaine, and I don't know what.
They like to imagine that they're creative.
Yeah.
And they all make the mistake of wanting to keep their jobs, rather than saying, everybody gets fired after 3 years, and I want to make the best 3 years worth of movies as I can before
yeah.
I go.
Then they start trying to hang on at any cost, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's end before we get depressed about the same movies, but thank you.
Thank you for listening. The Pinewood Dialogues at Museum of the Moving Image are made possible by generous support from the Pannonia Foundation. To learn more about the museum, visit www.movingimage.us.